Greetings from the World Newsroom in Boston. This is Jason Margolis, and this is Tech Podcast number 120. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Public Radio in Boston. It's getting a little chilly this week in Boston. Crisp. Crisp is the word I think I'm looking for, actually. I had to wear a jacket to work for the first time in a few months. Well, I guess that means summer is almost officially over. And speaking of cool temperature, some chilly stories for you this week. Kind of a cheesy segue, but in the Arctic, a bank filled with seeds. In Siberia, a story on the permafrost. Then we warm up a bit and head down under to Australia. We hear about the mood in Australia when it comes to tackling global warming. And last, a story about green tea. And I'd like to read some excerpts of letters from you. We begin, though, with a birthday celebration. 25 years and looking great. It's actually grown up and it's slimmer and faster. What am I talking about? The personal computer, or PC. In London, the company that makes computer chips, Intel, held an exhibition to celebrate 25 years of the PC. My colleague, the BBC's Oren Gordon, visited the Design Museum in London and spoke with Intel's Arun Shenoy to look back at how computers have evolved.
I'm here on the banks of the River Thames within sight of two of London's design classics. Tower Bridge, which is probably the most striking of the bridges across the River Thames, and the Gherkin, which is one big giant building in the shape of a giant sausage, a gherkin. To my left is a real Formula One motor car from the Sauber team, but we're not here to test drive that car. We're here to test drive the world's first personal computer, which by the standards of today's machines was very slow indeed. Let's go inside. We're standing in front of the PC, where it said it all began. Describe it for us.
1981, IBM made what was then considered to be a significant leap in the industry. They took a big risk. I seem to recall a lot of people at IBM didn't think that the PC actually had a market. So they took a very big risk at the time. They did a couple of very interesting things. One of the ones that essentially created what the PC industry is today, they opened up the specification of the PC to allow other vendors to come into the space. That created a significant amount of choice, lots of competition, of course. But I think that was probably the single biggest act in the history of the PC that created what the industry is today.
Not at all surprising that they thought that the PC didn't have a future, because if you look at this, it's quite bulky. Describe it for us.
You know, I worked at IBM in the mid-80s, and I remember working on these, and the one that we're looking at actually has a hard disk. That in itself was a significant evolution. The very first ones, of course, just had a single floppy drive, a monochrome screen. You had to know, exactly which command you had to use to get it to do what you wanted to do. Very, very clunky, horrendously noisy. There was no concept of multimedia. One of the main reasons for not having multimedia at the time, other than the technology not existing, was that the fans in the PCs were so loud it sounded like a vacuum cleaner.
And those are the vents we could see visible.
And one of the interesting byproducts, of course, is that that was where the air went into the machine to cool the components. And one of the biggest problems that the IBM PC had in the early days was that it had to be opened up very regularly and vacuum cleaned. Huge amounts of dust used to collect in there. Created havoc with the floppy drives, for example, so you couldn't run applications. Very, very tough.
I have got in my hand a USB dongle. Mm-hmm. How does this compare in memory to something, I guess, 100 times the size and weight? Or several hundred times the size and weight?
The device you're looking there is about 1,000 times bigger in terms of its capacity to hold data than the PC was at the time.
My little USB dongle.
And you know what? Your little USB dongle doesn't need to be plugged into the mains to keep its data. That was the problem with the PC at the time. If you switch it off, it lost everything it had on it.
Shall we move along? And yeah. What's the next stage in the evolution, if you like?
looking beyond the original IBM PC, we start to see the advent of new manufacturers into the industry, the Osborne.
What's the story with that tiny screen in the center there? It's next to useless.
It was a portable. The idea was that, you know, this was a PC that you could carry with you.
You're joking.
You know, you needed arms like Arnie to be able to carry one with you.
It is the size, if I can just describe it. There's a keyboard which is bigger and clunkier than the keyboards of today, but the main body is bigger than the hard drive of many desktop PCs. That's how big it is.
Well, I think if you look at it a slightly different way, I take a smaller bag with me when I travel that has an overnight change of clothing, my laptop, all of the paperwork that I have, every power cable that I could possibly have, my phone, my charger, and my MP3 player, and all of, a book perhaps, and it's still lighter than that whole box there.
I'm very tempted to pick it up and to give it a good old heft, but I think I'll leave it exactly where it is. Let's just move along if we can. And smaller keyboard, bigger, I suppose, more user-friendly screen. In fact, it looks a little bit like a small television. What are we looking at?
Well, the very first Sinclair, the ZX81. This was really when the PC, or the personal computer more broadly, made, I think, it sort of first step into the consumer space. When we talk about the IBM PC that we saw there and the Osborne and so on and so forth, they were very oriented towards the business user. This was the first time a PC went into the living room. You know, this was the kind of thing that children in their teens got as Christmas presents. They wrote little programs on there. They had the ability to play games. It had, well, what was at the time fantastic sound.
And monochrome screen still. We're not yet at the color screen stage.
Well, so interesting enough, the early PC also had a color screen. And I remember the upgrade, I think, cost something like $4,500 just so that you could have a color screen. And just to put it into perspective, you ended up with four colors.
Okay, we've got several stages to go through, and I think it's worth our while to skip a few of them and to go, as it were, to the next significant step.
I'd say this is probably a good place to stop. The PCs that came to being in the 90s, one of the other things that came along with, you know, all of the performance and all the wonderful features that Intel was bringing to the market was Microsoft Windows. The first time users had an ability to control the user interface, run applications using a mouse. As we went through the 90s, the next big thing that happened was mobility. If you think about the sort of mid-80s when Compaq and IBM came up with their luggable PCs, and the Osborne for that matter, very, very heavy, tiny screens, no color. But it was really the mid-90s where mobility really started to take off, where performance became something that was real. Battery life was something that was also real, you know, 2 or 3 hours, for example.
And the PC became truly portable.
And the PC became genuinely portable. You know, a lot of the language changed as well. People started to talk about, you know, work becoming something that you do and not a place that you go to. And it was really mobile computing that created that opportunity.
You've talked us through the various stages in the development of the PC. What are the possibilities? Where might it go in the future? What might it do?
Endless. Very hard to say. But we're all trying to get there in a real hurry.
If you want to keep something really safe, how about this? You lock it inside a vault, buried in a mountain, on an Arctic island, patrolled by polar bears. That's where they're about to start building a new global seed bank to ensure the long-term survival of the world's vital food crops. It affords protection against everything from local wars to an asteroid impact. Richard Hollingham of the BBC traveled to the Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard, the site of the new seed repository.
It was distinctly colder in this bit as we come through the door. Awful lot colder. Oh dear. So we've come about 1,000 kilometres from the North Pole. We've walked inside a mountain through two locked doors, down a long corridor, then through two very large padlocked doors, getting in through a sledgehammer and crowbar, and we come into this long, quite narrow room. And at the end, in the distance, just picked out by our headlights on our helmets, is a big black steel box. And that is the seed vault.
So this is it.
The existing vault is inside a disused coal mine, its tunnels deep in the permafrost, the walls glinting with icicles, like some sort of magical grotto. It was conceived during the Cold War, when nuclear conflict seemed a real possibility. These days, the threats to the world's crops are more mundane, but no less devastating. Kerry Fowler is the Executive Secretary of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. He's overseeing the effort to build the new global seed repository in Svalbard.
What we want to do there is to save the seeds of all the different varieties of our agricultural crops. And those seed varieties are, in fact, threatened. They're extremely valuable in the sense that they're the raw material for plant breeding. So if we want to have agriculture in the centuries ahead of us, we're going to need to save this diversity of our agricultural crops that will allow them to adapt to new environments.
What sort of threats are you talking about?
They range from the truly catastrophic, and that would be nuclear war or an asteroid hitting or something like that, to the more mundane but unfortunately much more common kind of disasters which affect individual seed banks. There are a number of seed bank collections around the world that serve plant breeders and other researchers, and they're very vulnerable to things like wars and civil strife, but also equipment failures and mismanagement and poor budgets, which affect seed banks routinely.
Here in Afghanistan, the war continues. There was a little activity.
The ongoing conflict in Afghanistan provides an all too real example of why seed banks are necessary. The Afghan seed bank has been raided twice by looters in 1992, then again in 2001. Both times they destroyed hundreds of seed samples bred over generations by traditional farmers. Dr. Nasrat Wasimi was working to rebuild the collection when the second raid took place.
I was really upset when you see that people just break into your offices and premises and take whatever they can at a gunpoint, and you look at it, oh my God, this small amount of seed, which is maybe 100, 200, or 400 grams, is of no value to the looter, but it destroys the genetic resources and potential of crop improvement for the country and for the international community.
Back in the vault, the director of the Nordic Seed Bank, Bent Skovmund, is carefully placing a glass vial of seed into a polystyrene-lined packing case, which will then be nailed shut. He told me why they're going to so much effort.
Seeds are actually a package of genetic information. We today know part of the genetic profile of some of the seed and what traits are in that profile, but some of the traits we need in the future we haven't even identified yet.
The new global seed vault will be even more secure than the present one. Carved into a nearby mountain, it'll have electricity and air conditioning. And rather than a few thousand different seed types currently preserved in Svalbard, the new repository will contain millions of seeds, from Argentinian soybeans to Zambian maize. So how long will the vault last? Kerry Fowler.
We're building it with the expectation that it will essentially last forever. This facility is going to be built inside of a mountain. It's basically going to tunnel in solid stone, and then we're going to put a meter of reinforced concrete on the walls, ceilings, and floors. It's going to have a couple of very secure doors, security systems. We're going to need the biological diversity, the crop diversity that it stores. We're going to need this for as long as we're going to need agriculture. So as long as human beings want to be on planet Earth, this is the resource we've got to protect.
With any luck, we'll never have to use a global seed vault. But if the worst happens, there's no harm in having insurance.
Like it or not, the technological challenge of our day will be battling global warming and climate change. I wish we could fill this podcast with other more uplifting stories. But as a member of the media and as a global citizen, I feel it's my duty to share and for all of us to know as much as we can about climate change. By bringing you these stories, I hope I'm not filling you with despair. but rather hope. Hope, that is, that technology can help stem the tide of this potentially catastrophic situation. But from everything I read, and from my own reporting, having talked to dozens and dozens of scientists, it's looking more and more like we need to act quickly. Global warming could be happening far faster than predicted. Scientists in Siberia have discovered that the permafrost, that's ground that's been frozen for tens of thousands of years, is starting to melt. That's releasing vast amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, potentially accelerating climate change. The BBC's environmental correspondent David Shuckman traveled to Siberia, inside the Arctic Circle, for this report.
I'm flying over the far north of Siberia. Below me are countless lakes, a new alarm bell of global warming, because there are more lakes than ever before, and they're stirring. Bubbles of methane rise to the surface. Methane is one of the most powerful greenhouse gases. Scientists here have discovered that the lakes are generating far more methane than previously thought. This has the potential to accelerate climate change. The research has been carried out by American and Russian scientists at the remote Northeast Science Center at Chersky. Sergei Zimov is its director.
If global warming will continue, our lake will very quickly activate it. Ice begin to melt. Why? Because greenhouse methane is very important greenhouse gas. It will provocate warming of climate very fast.
An armored personnel carrier ferries us over the mud. This is the best way to get around. Beneath this spongy land, there's what's called permafrost, ground that's permanently frozen, except when the climate changes. Now land that's been frozen for 40,000 years is starting to melt, and the ancient soils, rich in carbon, are giving off greenhouse gases. And this matters, because one-fifth of the Earth's surface is permafrost, and the Arctic is warming faster than anywhere else on the planet. The result could be a doubling of the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. Melissa Chapin is part of the research team.
If these greenhouse gases are given off in greater and greater quantities, we get a vicious cycle started. That is, as we warm the permafrost, it gives off more gases that make the Earth warmer, which warms the permafrost even more. And all of the changes that have been predicted that might happen as a result of global warming will happen at a faster and faster rate. And I'm talking about things like rising of the sea levels, changes in agriculture, changes in lifestyle, just hot days that we will all be experiencing. And so what's going on here in Siberia is extremely important to somebody who's living in New York City or London or Tokyo.
Already people here are seeing their world shift beneath their feet. In the towns and cities of Siberia, huge holes are torn in the roads where the permafrost melts, and buildings often collapse. A milder climate might seem more attractive, but not when it threatens the foundations of life itself. But there is one benefit. The melting of the permafrost is unearthing the remains of extinct animals, like the woolly mammoths. We watch a heavy bone being pulled from the mud.
Sergei Davidov found the bones of mammoths. Be careful.
Yeah. Just
and
in
now
the mud
he
here.
Will show you how it's located in permafrost.
So can you get it out of the mud?
Yes. Right. Just a moment. Sergei, show, please.
Okay, let's see that.
Покажи, Сергей. Oh.
It's pretty big.
No, it's not so big.
Not so big.
It's only half of these bones.
And which bit of bone is that?
It's bones from leg.
From the leg. And how old could this be?
Oh, it's around 25,000 years, because it's top level of the exposure, and age of the sediments around 25,000 years.
25,000 years old, an exciting event to witness. But for the scientists studying this land, the retreat of the ice spells trouble. For years, this region was closed to the outside world. Now, the gases rising from this ocean of Arctic mud have the power to change it.
Next up, we'll go down to the southern hemisphere, to Australia. Here's an interview conducted by the host of The World, Lisa Mullins, with the BBC's Phil Mercer in Sydney. It's about how Australia is viewing climate change.
Climate change was the subject of a recent phone conversation between former Vice President Al Gore and the Australian Prime Minister John Howard. Al Gore is in Australia to promote An Inconvenient Truth. That's the movie about climate change that features Gore lecturing on the subject. The former vice president is using his trip down under to urge Australian politicians to take action against climate change. The BBC's Phil Mercer is in Sydney, Australia, and it sounds as if Al Gore, whether wittingly or not, sparked a spat among leaders in Australia. What happened?
Well, we've known for a long time the position of the Australian government when it comes to the Kyoto Protocol. It says that signing the climate treaty would effectively damage Australia's booming economy. The main opposition Labour Party sees things very differently. It believes that Australia should sign up to Kyoto, and it says that because Australia emits more greenhouse gases per person than any other country, Australia has an obligation to its international colleagues to do so. So one would imagine that Al Gore coming to Australia the week that An Inconvenient Truth opens in Australian cinemas, he will know, one would imagine, full well that his views will once again stoke those fires.
Is the popular opinion behind the Prime Minister John Howard's stand on this?
Australia has vast reserves of coal. It's one of the world's biggest consumers of fossil fuels. Electricity and energy prices for the domestic consumer in Australia are, internationally speaking, relatively low. So in that regard, Australians maybe look inside their wallet when they decide how they view climate change. Climate change is obviously a burning concern for everyone, but Australia's economy is being propelled by this resource sector. Will Australians countenance a fall in economic productivity and a rise in prices to try to combat climate change? Well, that's a debate that will rage for another few years. Certainly at the moment, Australians are enjoying this unprecedented economic boom. And I would say with mortgage rates, with interest rates rising here in Australia, many people in across this vast continent would be quite happy the way things are. Of course, there are vast numbers of people, and they're not just environmentalists, who care deeply about climate change. And Al Gore has raised some very interesting issues that have been debated in the past here in Australia, saying that if Australia doesn't do something soon, it will increasingly become a continent at the mercy of more bushfires, water shortages, an increased number of powerful cyclones, and threats to the Great Barrier Reef. So there are many indications that Australia and Australians will have to confront this issue sooner rather than later.
Can you tell me what kind of profile Al Gore has in Australia, what people make of him and his message?
It's interesting listening to the radio programs this evening, driving home and flicking on the television news. Much of the coverage is about An Inconvenient Truth, but also there's a great deal of coverage about and speculation about what the world would have been like had Al Gore been elected president rather than George W. Bush. For example, would the United States have gone to war in Iraq? No, says Al Gore. And that has ramifications for Australia, because Australia still is supporting the US-led campaign in the Gulf as it did in Afghanistan. So much of the coverage is about climate change, but also a great deal of speculating on what the world would have been like under President Al Gore.
Speaking to us from Sydney, Australia, the BBC's Phil Mercer. Thank you, Phil.
Anytime.
I want to add anything that I can add.
You're listening to music composed by the world's very own Alex Galifant. The multi-talented Alex plays trumpet, guitar, drums, and a little keyboard. And if you think that's impressive, you should see him on the soccer field, or as his people say, the football pitch. In the past few weeks, I've been receiving a lot of very nice and helpful letters from you, listeners, and I'd like to share an excerpt from a couple of those letters. Daniel Coggins from Italy writes what he calls a tech reflection. Daniel says, "My first computer experiences in 1984 were word processors. In college, I typed papers on paper and handed them in. I used to type long and interesting letters to friends and family. I would put stamps on them and send them in the mail. Now that there is internet and email, I don't write long letters anymore. What has happened? Why? Do I have less time? Have I become less patient? Are emails just too easy somehow? Any thoughts? Sincerely, Daniel Coggins." Well, Daniel, I guess my brief thought is this. I think you're right. And while I love email, it's made our communication much more robust and simpler, I agree, it is sad that the thousands of year old art of letter writing seems to be dying. So you've inspired me. I'll write a letter on paper to somebody this week. One more thought, this coming from England. Aaron Kalar would like to hear more stories about next generation game consoles. We'll work on getting some more stories like that. This weekend, in fact, somewhat related to this request, in Las Vegas, the World Cyber Games are holding their American Championships. The winners will go to Italy to compete in the World Cyber Games with the best gamers from around the world. While I can't make it to Vegas this weekend, I'm told I'll be able to talk to one of the winners next week. So hopefully we'll bring you something on that next week in the podcast. Thanks again for all your letters. My email again is jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk, jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk. For our final story this week, a story about green tea. Now you might be thinking, what does green tea have to do with technology? Well, not much. And a lot. This is sort of an anti-technology story of sorts. Technology is helping us develop all these great new medicines, pills, and life-extending breakthroughs. But it turns out that one of the best ways to stay healthy comes from one of the oldest technologies, the art of learning about the beneficial properties of simple plants. It turns out that just drinking some green tea might be one of the best ways to stay healthy. The World's David LaVallee filed this brief report on green tea.
In a study released today, scientists from Tohoku University explored whether green tea is all it's cracked up to be. In short, they concluded that those who drank 5 cups of green tea each day had a 31% lower risk of cardiovascular disease compared with those who had less than 1 cup a day. But the study also found no evidence that drinking green tea prevents cancer. Green tea has long been studied for its possible health benefits, but drinking the stuff is more art than science. Like Japanese calligraphy or flower arrangement, the way of tea requires skill, imagination, and ritual. There are a number of ways for the uninitiated to get into the way of green tea. Diane Rosen, who wrote The Book of Green Tea, has this all-important tip.
Boiling water should never be used to make green tea. And that's the mistake that a lot of people do. They get some green tea, they use their boiling water, they steep it for 3 to 5 minutes and say, this tastes terrible.
Steeping green tea in less than boiling water prevents the tea from becoming bitter. But once brewed properly, Rosen says drinking green tea is a form of pleasure therapy. Sipping a cup by yourself can be a meditative moment, a little oasis of peace and quiet. Sharing tea offers other benefits.
Part of the pleasure of enjoying tea is sharing it. You don't need to have the most expensive pot or the most incredible handmade cup, but everything should be selected with the personality and the interest of your guest. Everything you do should be a gesture of invitation, and you want everybody who is sharing your tea to feel important and essential to this experience. by choosing the very best tea and preparing it carefully to embrace your guest, you are doing the ultimate sharing of self and things. And that's part of what the experience of tea is all about.
So drinking green tea does have its benefits, no matter what the scientists say. You make friends, and those who drink it regularly insist green tea is an elixir that nourishes both mind and body. For The World, I'm David LaValle.
In a little tribute to green tea, we close the program with some music from Japan. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
風を見荒らせが来た